committee to order. We're going to proceed according to schedule and as published. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 251. I'm going to ask Greg McMurdo to come up and tell us again why we're doing this. And be as brief as possible, Greg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For your record, Greg McMurdo from the Department of Education. I can be really very brief. This bill would change the time period for which state board waivers can be granted from anywhere from 1 year to 5 years rather than the current 3 years to 5 years. And it would also allow the state board to approve timeline extensions from a period of 1 year to 5 year rather than 1 year to 2 years. In the first case, the state board believes that a waiver, a potential of a waiver for a period of longer, a shorter period than 3 years is appropriate and gives them more discretion. And similarly, with respect to the timeline extensions, they believe that a longer period of time, a longer time range, would allow districts to do better planning.
Are there any questions or comments from the committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Greg, I wasn't here for the hearings on this, but can you assure me this in no way changes the standards or the quality of what we've been trying to do for 10 years here with the Act?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Hartung, I can assure you that it does not. It gives both districts, actually gives districts greater flexibility in how they deal with the Act.
Thank you.
There are no further discussion. Thanks, Greg. Appreciate that. Chair would entertain a motion to move this to the floor with a due pass.
I so move, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hartung has moved Senate Bill 251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Our next agenda item is the Financial Aid Commission report. And I would invite those who are making this report to come forward, please.
Didn't I see that one of your junior high school scored big in some sort of
Roosevelt.
Yes. Yeah. True. Pretty good school district, huh?
Pretty good school district.
Chairman, please. And members of the committee, for the record, I am Roger Bassett, one of the co-chairs of the Financial Aid Commission, which was created by House Bill 2993, enacted last session. Mark Dodson is the other co-chair, and Mark was unable to be here today. I'm here to present to you the report of that commission, of that interim commission. Joining me immediately to my right is Dr. Nancy Goldschmidt, who is Associate Vice Chancellor of the University System and also served very ably and very patiently as the staff director for the work of this commission. Also here at the hearing stand, Dr. Faith Gabelneck and Dr. Lee Pelton, President Faith Gabelneck and President Lee Pelton, both of whom were members of the commission. Jeff Sveitzer from the Student Assistance Commission, also an ex officio member of the commission, is in the room, and I think that touches on all of the members that are present. House Bill 2993 was drafted pretty narrowly in terms of the assignment that you asked us to address. I'd like to describe it as inviting us to think inside the box rather than outside of it. And the box has been created over time by pressure on what has always been an underfunded Oregon, now called Oregon Opportunity Grant. So responding to those pressures and inviting some time to be spent during the interim, you asked us to address three pretty fundamental policy questions related to state-funded financial aid for post-secondary education. And the first of those you asked us to address is what balance should be struck between the purpose of supporting institutions through this kind of state assistance compared with the purpose of supporting students, assisting students. Or, if you prefer, since most all of this is framed around the existing and very successful Oregon Opportunity Grant, another way to paraphrase that charge might be, is the Oregon Opportunity Grant a resource to students or to institutions? Second challenge you gave us, again, a question of balance. What balance should be struck through the state-funded student assistance program between need as a basis for award and merit as a basis for award? Merit, usual example of merit being usually expressed as scholarships. Or paraphrasing that one, is the Oregon Opportunity Grant for everyone or for a selected, against some criteria, selected few? Your third challenge is a little more difficult for us to boil down to the gist of it. I cited two specific issues that I know were on your table last session in the financial aid and post-secondary ed policy arena. One of those was a search for a way to provide an incentive to community college graduates to transfer and continue their education at a four-year institution. You were interested in whether state-funded student financial assistance might be used to encourage that transition. The bill also mentioned incentives of some form for achievers of the Certificate of Initial Mastery, or I think it also mentioned high achievers on any other kind of college entrance exam. So you invited us to look at those. We rephrased that issue to make it more like a category. Should there be in state student assistance policy a category that encourages the use of that kind of a student assistance as an incentive for any purpose? And there are a lot of other examples that belong in that category, the most frequently mentioned of which is incentives to keep Oregon students in the state in one way or another. So there are many ideas one can come up with, and we knocked around a few of them, but finally I decided that rather than just address the two specific points that were made in the bill, we'd treat that more as a category. And the question then is, what place, or if you think of the funds for the opportunity grant as limited, what displacement is appropriate in order to create a third purpose, a purpose having to do with incentives for certain kinds of student attendance behavior. In the membership for the commission, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but it was real clear in reading the bill that your membership clearly called for us to find common interest among the several historically competing sectors, the community college sector, the university system, and the independent college sector. So, significantly, you placed on this commission four members of each of those sectors, two presidents, two presidents, one board member, and one student. You also had four legislators. Senator Gordley was one of the legislature's members of our commission. So was Senator Q-Tub, and then in the House, Representative Morissette and Representative Williams served. The chancellor, the community college commissioner, and the director of the Student Assistance Commission served ex officio. So we had at the table all of the interests. We had the chief policymakers that really wrestle with the question of access to post-secondary education. We had leadership from your assembly, and then the governor had two appointments, and he chose to use those to create co-chairs, and that was the role that I was asked to take on with Mark Dodson. So in summary, cutting through a lot of work and answering and returning again to those three charges, the commission, in looking at the question of whether the purpose of a state-funded student financial aid should be primarily or balanced in favor of support for institutions versus support for students, came down squarely on the side of the policy should be to support the student. In other words, financial aid should enable the student to make student choices about attendance and should not be seen or perceived as an entitlement or a form of assistance to institutions. To the second question, whether need or merit should receive the greater attention, the Commission resolved that balance in our minds in favor of need, that the financial need of the student should be the chief, if not exclusive, purpose of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. To the third question of whether incentives should take their place in the midst of this appropriation to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, we acknowledge that's a category worth pursuing, but it should not be pursued unless and until the Oregon Opportunity Grants are fully funded. So useful, I think, to consider in that case whether there are certain kinds of attendance behavior that you would like to encourage, like transfer or completion of the Certificate of Initial Mastery, but that responsibility shouldn't be loaded on this appropriation unless and until the grants are fully funded. We believe we achieved your implied wish that we bring all of the competing interests together. Our specific recommendations closely reflected the budget request, the agency budget request of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. We didn't start there. We ended up there because of the obvious success of that program and the manner in which it meets the recommendations or the conclusions we reached about how these two forms of balance should be struck. The governor's budget request did not forward that to you, so the situation you face is our recommendations, which would have worked a lot better with a lot more money than you might think are no longer relevant, but let me urge you to think otherwise. In putting this together, we thought of it in terms of a framework. Our overriding interest was in more students through the door to post-secondary education. In that sense, and this is the way I characterize it as a co-chair, in that sense, we invite a view of the role of the State General Fund in this matter of student financial assistance as an investment in individual opportunity, more than a question of restraint in government expenditures or concerns about whether there's enough money to go around. So for the longer view, which we urge upon you, we hope these recommendations might be a framework for more than just one session, we are inviting you to think of the state's role here as encouraging more post-secondary education opportunity rather than cost savings in some fashion or another within the program. Secondly, as we attempted to provide a framework for these, we believe they're functional at any level of general fund. They could guide your decisions at any level of general fund. In that sense, I refer you both to the official report of the commission. The third page of the executive summary contains the recommendations. And Gary and Dean and his organization have put together a brochure that summarizes the same recommendations. Essentially, they call for attention to the Oregon Opportunity Grant program by assuring year-round eligibility so that we don't have access cut off during the mid-academic year, an increase in the award size, both to recognize differences of cost among institutions and to recognize the increasing burden on the individual student of college attendance, period. And finally, to pay attention to some differences that still exist between independent students and dependent students in their eligibility. So it can't get all the way there with the recommendation, at least not the recommendation that's in the governor's budget on those three things, but we do believe those should frame your thinking and the thinking of others as you continue to pursue what we hope would be the goal of maximum numbers of Oregonians able to go through the door to a post-secondary education. What I'd like to do is invite President Gableneck and President Felton to add comments, Mr. Chair, and then be happy to take questions.
Appreciate that. That would be great. Please.
Well, I'm delighted to be here and to have served on this commission. I think that Just underscoring what you just heard, this provided us at one level an opportunity for the three major educational or higher educational organizations, the community colleges, the public higher ed institutions, and the independent college higher ed institutions to work together. I think all of us were very committed to our focus, which is on students. I can't really emphasize enough how important it is that Oregon step up to the plate in support of its students. We can provide you with great numbers of data, but the overarching spirit and the stance has to be that our students need your help. The fact of the matter is that students in this state attend all three types of institutions. I was with the group from the Western Interstate Higher Education Commission, WICHE, and we spoke about perhaps having even a common transcript or a common path, because students come into our systems from any point. They may start at a community college and go to a private institution. They may start at a private institution, take a couple of courses in a community college, then go to a public institution, any sort of combination. And as they do that, they have to negotiate their aid. And if they are in the state system and they get one package of aid, once they come to another portion of our educational system here, they may lose their aid, they have to renegotiate it. Anyway, it's not a good system. So part of where we are standing right now is for you to really think about the needs of Oregonian students and the fact that they move around. We support, as you heard, certainly keeping in place the monies already allocated, just as a start. And then we would also urge you to look at the recommendations of the commission in terms of additional funding. While $55 million is something, of course, we would love, because it would then just bring us to the average in the United States, we realize that this budget is pressed in many ways, as are all budgets. And so we would really urge you to consider some partial funding this year, as Roger said, looking at this as a kind of a next step. Even if it's a baby step, it becomes a commitment. The final thing that I think we should remember is, in surveying the growth in students in the Northwest, we will see a growth in the numbers of students wanting to go to college. It's over 20%. The majority of those students' skin is brown. These are our most needy students. And if we are to live and walk the talk of access and wanting our future leaders to succeed by going to college, we as a state cannot stand idly by and fund at the level that we're currently doing. Our neighbors to the north and our neighbors to the south are doing a lot better. I think we can do it if we have the will to do it, and I would urge you to consider and read this report and think about ways to start the ball rolling. Thank you.
Thank you. I think my colleague has spoken very well and has said a lot of what I would like to say. But let me, however, just do two things. One is to state a principle, and then second to state a fact.
Would you please put your name on the record for us?
My name is Lee Pelton. I'm the president of that small college across the street. And I'm glad to be here, and as you've already heard, I was very pleased to be a part of this commission and its work. I've been in education all my life. It's really the only thing I know and I think do well. I understand, obviously, in this state and other states and in the nation, that our educational system, and by that I mean from K to 16, is a significant issue for us. It's an important facet of American life that deserves all the attention that we can give it. And I
I'm just going to state an obvious principle, and that principle is that, you know, our state, the region, and the nation depends on institutions of higher learning being able to educate young men and women to go out into the world and become citizens of a participatory democracy, and also to acquire those skills that will move forward our economic and social agendas. And I hope that as we attempt in this state and other parts of the nation, as we attempt to manage our funding for education, that we not neglect one part of the K through 16 equation at the expense of the other. It's important that we get students, young people, off to a good start, but it's also important that they finish strongly, and they finish strongly at institutions of higher learning. And so that's the principle. The fact that I want to state, and I may be a little more blunt than my colleague, is that Oregon's commitment to higher education in this can be described at best as lackluster. And I believe that we can do better, and I hope that all of you will agree with me that we can and should do better. You know, I note that when we compare the state grant dollars per resident population, at least in 1997 and 98, and these are figures that are in the report on page 38, that Oregon's per resident grant dollars is about half of that of California, and about a third of that of Washington. And it is well below the national average. That does not speak to me to a real commitment, and it doesn't speak to me to a commitment to excellence in higher education. I also note with some sadness that if we look at the percentage of need-based state aid for students as a percentage of the total amount of dollars that we spend on higher education in Oregon in a two-year period, the percentage of need-based state aid is about 2.6%. And to put that in some relative terms, the average at the state average of that number in the United States is 7%, so less than half of the average in the state, in the nation, in this state. So I think that we, at least I would hope that we would commit ourselves to doing much better than we are currently doing as regards state aid for students. If there's any one single overriding message that I hope that you take from this report, is that it is imperative that we put more money in the hands of students, so that they can have broader access and increased choice. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Deckard and then Senator Gordley.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, it's good to see you, Roger. I noticed on this it says 4858 Shady Tree Lane in Turner. It just seems like such an idyllic, relaxing place to be, so I hope, I'm sure it is. To the presidents, thank you for taking time to be with us. Curious if the commission spoke about a needs-based, merit-based scholarship program. A couple of us are working or kicking through an idea of whether by means testing a merit-based scholarship program for public or private, and hopefully bringing new resources to the table, you can achieve hopefully both goals by placing a means test on it, ensuring that it goes in a needs-based manner, but also incorporating the concept that Georgia did or others of that you have to maintain a certain GPA, a B, to qualify.
We did not directly, for the record, excuse me, my name, Senator Starr, members of the committee, is Nancy Goldschmidt, Associate Vice Chancellor, Oregon University System. One of the things that we did do is look at the relationship between student status and financial need, and on page 41, there's kind of a grid that would combine low to high financial means to attend versus wide access versus narrowly best and brightest. If one were to make priorities in terms of where you wanted to allocate need-based aid, first I'd like to say that the current requirements do require a student to maintain a certain average to receive to continue receiving aid, but the question is, I think maybe should that come into play in the beginning? I think if you look at California and their big statement they've made about commitment to need, it is based, the cutoffs are based, the amount you get is based on the high school GPA and scores on performance tests.
Yes, sir.
If you want to pursue that, but
here's just the thought I have, and I see Georgia on page 38, which these statistics are very alarming. I think on the opposite page, 39, is, again, alarming for many of the reasons that we have a 20% increase in demand for higher education, and the need for higher education to compete in a world economy is just essential. So our goal that a couple of us are working on is to really elevate us up to where, or at least taking from some of the example that Georgia provided, is using that system to say that any child in Oregon, if on a means-tested basis so that you get the need in there, that if you meet a certain criteria, you're in at a level that we can afford. Because in this
you're
budget...
In what? You're in where?
You're in either public or private. The way we've structured it... my co-sponsor is here on the dais with me, and we're still working on the details. But the way we've structured it is to say at a certain level, because of the budget constraints and where we came up with some additional revenue, at a certain level, you will, if you can meet this needs and then we means test it, the average or better, you're in. And I think we use the highest in-state from a public, but you'd go to private or public. So it is student-centered. It follows the student. It's just the budgetary constraints that we have. We couldn't say, and I think Georgia does say this, you're in and everywhere, which would be wonderful. And I think this moves us several yards down the field in terms of achieving that. But
would you make a statement by the end that the only thing that I would just want to make sure about is that the student has a scholarship, but he or she can use the scholarship to go to choose where that person wants to go, and that it's not an automatic admission to any particular type of institution.
Not automatic, but it follows the student.
Follows the student.
Correct.
Yeah.
When they gain admission.
Right. And the Georgia system is funded by lottery tickets. Is that kind of what you're thinking about? No. Good.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all of the folks on the panel. I can refer to you as my colleagues in this effort that has brought the recommendations forward. And I would like to comment on some of what I've heard from the panel and also, issue a challenge to my colleagues here on the legislative panel with me. I think that the recommendations, I know, the recommendations contained in the commission report provide another example of why we need to engage in a conversation about tax reform, tax restructuring, creating new revenue streams to pay for unmet needs, including the needs of our students. And that's currently not a discussion that a majority of us are willing to have in this building, but it must go forward at some point. And it's also a discussion, a conversation that must take place on the part of all Oregonians. Again, if you look at the recommendations of the commission on page 3 in the executive summary, and those that include a cost, we're talking about $55 million, as I believe it was Dr. Gabelnick said, to be average. Well, that's pitiful. We can do better. I believe that. Dr. Pelton said that Oregon's commitment is at best lackluster, and that is also pitiful, and we can do better, and I believe that as well. But believing it and doing something about it is a stretch that, Mr. Chair, we need to engage. We need to get engaged in that stretch that will take us to the revenue discussion. Our students are worth it. The investment in the longer view that Mr. Bassett spoke to, the investment in individual opportunity is something that we must get to. Now, I don't know how many more examples we need as legislators serving in the first session of the 21st century. I don't know how many more examples we need that tell us that we have got to look differently at how we make investments in our future. This should be sobering to all of us. It is certainly sobering to me from where I sit. I don't want to sit here in the position of lecturing my colleagues, but most certainly, if we don't come away from our hearing today remembering anything, to understand that we are only talking about $55 million to be average, is it just isn't good enough. We are better than that. We are better than that as Oregonians. And understanding that we are better than that, what are we going to do about it? What are we willing to commit to change this picture?
Mr. Chair. Senator Fisher.
I don't want to make any undue accusations, but there's an awful lot of statistics that are missing out of this thing. This examines the state grant dollars. It doesn't say anything about what we're putting into, what our tuition compares to other states or anything else. I know that looking down this list of states, that many of them that are listed here as having practically nothing in the way of NEED grants have excellent college programs and things in their states. They're certainly not states where everybody's shelling out and going somewhere else for education because it's cheaper. So I think that we've got to know what we're doing and compare apples to oranges, because if we're not requiring anyways near as high a tuition fees and stuff like that, but our grants are down compared to other people, but other people are giving great high grants because their tuition is high, this all has a tendency to pan out. And my guess is that when we're compared, even as there, you know, is a fluctuation of basically twice the amount of per capita income per state, going from 18,751 up to 36,364 as a top average,
That's relatively twice, rounded off twice the income. So there's that discrepancy in the total income, and yet you go over here to the grant needs, and there's literally 35 times, if you look at South Dakota with nothing, and you go up to New York with nearly $36. So my guess is that North Dakota certainly has some colleges that are there. Somewhere or another, there people are finding ways to go to college. And I know that a lot of them are farming communities. They're having some of the same problems on their farms and their hog ranches and their stock ranches and things like that that we're having here in Oregon. And so before I make a lot of judgment about whether we're coming up to standards or whether we're really doing our part or not, I'd have to know how we compare and all the other issues of tuition and what it actually costs a person to attend one of our schools.
Chairman Starr and Senator Fisher, I noted at the outset that we were given a fairly specific charge. You know, it was pretty limited to speak to the state-funded student financial assistance. But I would like to concur, not just for purposes of comparison to other states, but also for this body, as you wrestle with the value of an opportunity for a college education, that you must consider tuition, you must consider state assistance to institutions, you must consider the whole investment. Oregon generally ranks high on tuition, middle to low in student and support to institution and institutions, and not very good on student assistance either. We are, even when one looks at all sources of funds and considers all pieces of a market basket, if you want to call that, of college opportunity, we haven't made good on what most people would call a commitment for something like universal access. And I think it's if I may bridge back to a comment Senator Gordley made, our budget constraints are revenue constraints, self-inflicted for the most part. We have a general fund that's limited. It's been limited by actions of taxpayers who have chosen to restrict the amount of money that's available there. If I were to reach through all of the work of this commission and look for some broader point than just what we bring to you as recommendations, it is that that's pretty short-sighted in a state that values its people as a source of its economic well-being. And it's not just kids coming out of college, it's adults and others who, for whom another year or two of education in some form is going to be essential to all of us. So I don't know how we unlock that bind either, but your question is appropriate. Anyone should answer those questions on the way to asking a larger investment. I thought several times in my role as a co-chair that it would have been better had we had a broader charter to look at all of that rather than just to the question of financial aid and whether on the margin of a budget constraint it could be a little better than it is today. It's a very limited kind of view, and it's that limit marches itself right up to the doorsteps of a whole lot of young people and adults in this state who would benefit greatly by more education than they're now able to get.
We have a very thorough report, and I thank you for your good work, and you've set a challenge before us that I think that we need to seriously look at in our planning for our future and how we do meet the increasing needs of students and the increasing need for college education. Thank you very much. We had planned to try to hold this to 30 minutes because of some time constraints, and I do so appreciate your being here and helping us with this report.
Thank you for your interest in it.
Thank you. With that, we're going to move on to a public hearing on SCR 6. And we know we're...
May I come with you?
Invite Senator Clarno and Senator Bishop and Betsy Johnson, I believe, wanted to testify as well. Don't know where she is at the moment.
I think you're going to find her.
Someone's going to locate... Here she is now. Representative Johnson, please come forward. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe somebody's going to start talking if I don't quit testifying in front of your committee so much. I really enjoyed testifying the other day, and I went home for the town hall that Senator Starr had my committee and saw some of the tribe folks that were there and thought you were a great committee, and I told them I agreed. For the record, I'm Bev Clarno, State Senator, and I've introduced this bill in honor of a citizen in our community who I think deserves this recognition, and I hope you will pass this bill out of committee. You've already have the resolution in front of you, of course, and I just share with you a couple of things that I would like to tell you about Becky, who's such a well-loved and wonderful person in our community. I think sometimes what we do is wait until someone's gone to say thanks, and to me that's not the appropriate time. The time is now. Becky was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and grew up in a small Ohio railroad and farming community. She graduated from high school, second in her class, and attended Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. In 1942, following Pearl Harbor, she volunteered and was accepted for officer training in the Waves. And I'm sure probably everybody on the panel knows what the Waves are, but just in case, it's women accepted for volunteer emergency service in the U.S. Naval Reserves. She was called to active duty in 1943 and was in the Portland office when she met Captain Samuel S. Johnson. They were married later, and they have two daughters, Betsy Johnson and Patty, in Florida. In 1948, Sam and Becky founded the S.S. Johnson Foundation, and Becky has served as its president since Sam's death. Sam was a legislator in the House for 7 years, a legislator, and was mayor of Redmond when he died suddenly in 1984. Because of the foundation that Sam and Becky founded, her family has always been involved in civic and social and nonprofit organizations, and they have been able, with this foundation, to make contributions to organizations in the fields of education, science, health care, arts, culture, social services, and grants and loans to post-secondary students. In 1962, Becky was elected a school board member in Redmond. Then Governor Hatfield appointed her to the Oregon State Board of Higher Education, where she served for 13 years. She also served for 7 years as the governor appointment by Governor Straub as a member of the Oregon Educational Coordinating Commission. And then she was again appointed by Governor Attia in 1982 as a public member of the Oregon Teachers Standards and Practices Commission. Nationally, Mrs. Johnson has served on many national boards, including the Association of Governing Boards of Colleges and Universities. A longtime board member, Mrs. Johnson has served with distinction on the Oregon Historical Society, Central Oregon District Hospital, the High Desert Museum, Lewis and Clark College, Pacific University, Deschutes County Historical Society, Central Oregon Council on Aging, Oregon 4-H Foundation, and the advisory group to the Deschutes National Forest, and the museum at Warm Springs, and these are just to name a few things Becky has done. She has been an active supporter and volunteer for capable political candidates and community needs. Mrs. Johnson has been honored with many awards, awarded by Lewis and Clark College. She is one of the leading Oregon women leaders in the Book of Images of Oregon, Women Oregon in Oregon. And in 1993, Becky was among the first recipients of the Oregon Historical Society's Thomas Jefferson Award. And recently, a medical clinic in Redmond was named in honor of Sam and Becky Johnson in 1997. And a year ago, in the spring of 2000, the Redmond Community Center for Services to Children and Families was named in her honor. It's called the Becky Johnson Community Center, and this is a tribute to Becky's lifelong commitment to improving the lives of children and families. And in addition to all of these things, Becky and her husband Sam, years ago, dedicated part of their forest land property, the head of the Metolius, the headwaters of the Metolius, to be enjoyed forever by the public. And this is just a few of the things that Mrs. Johnson has done in our community and for our state. I will appreciate you considering and passing out this resolution. And with me is Sandy, who wanted to speak also.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop, and I haven't been called Sandy since I grew up in East Center Oregon in Redmond with Mrs. Johnson. So it's great. It's perfect. I wanted to really thank you all for taking time out of your busy schedules to really stop and just pause and honor a person like Mrs. Johnson. I still can't quite call her Becky. I grew up in Redmond, as I said. Betsy and I actually were in the same class through grade school. As the resolution highlights Mrs. Johnson's public service and shows you the contributions that she made in the boardroom and on the various boards and commissions, what I want to do today is just give you a little flavor of her presence on the front porch and in the neighborhood. Sam and Becky Johnson were touchstones for all of the young people that grew up in Redmond. It was a pretty small community, but you always knew that whatever was going on, you had a problem, anything, you could always go to the Johnsons. They were always there for the kids. Way before it became popular to donate land to the public domain, they just took everybody up to the headwaters of the Metolius every once in a while. They'd take half the school up there. So their incredible generosity and the way they lived their lives, both Sam and Becky, has been such an inspiration to all the young people that grew up there. Becky especially, Mrs. Johnson especially, with just being able to look at a woman like that in the community for a role model. You know, the kind of service and things that she had done when it was not popular to be a powerful woman. So I just really wanted to take the time today to thank you for passing this resolution.
And Mr. Chair, I would say that we did call Representative Johnson up here, whose mother we're honoring, but she said she was kind of reluctant to say anything. I can't imagine Representative Johnson being reluctant to say anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Obviously, I'm deeply honored that you would consider recognizing my mother. I would like her were she not my mother. She's a terrific lady and has been an inspiration for me in all aspects of my life. I thank you very much for your consideration.
Comments or questions?
Yes.
Senator Hartung.
Senator Clarno, thank you so much for bringing this before us, and Betsy and Ms. Bishop. I first came to this legislature in 1967 in the House, and Sam Johnson was one of the first persons I met, and I tell you, from that day on, he was my hero. He knew more about revenue, and I can always remember him educating Earl Blumenauer. Didn't do really a complete job, but to educate him about revenue, and Earl was on the revenue committee. I can remember, like it was yesterday, my first assignment with Becky Johnson. It really was a novel idea. Establish a single board of education for K through 12 and community colleges and higher ed. Wow, we met and met and met on that. And I just really am so proud to know Becky and to have known Sam, and now you. I like everything about you except your political registration. But you know, I have a few good friends who are Democrats, and you're good enough to be a Republican, so that's all right.
Thank you, Senator Hartung.
Yeah, but thank you so much for what Becky has done and what Sam did and what I know that you're going to do, and I'm honored to be listed on the as one of the sponsors of this concurrent resolution. Thank you so much.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sure some of you know, but thanks to Ramona Kennedy in the House, Betsy, Representative Johnson, was able to be seated in the desk held by her father 35 years ago, and her mother was sitting with her father when he was sworn in and sitting with her daughter. So I think it's a wonderful story. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Senator Fisher.
Yeah, I just have to ask a personal question. In reading this, I see absolutely nothing about flying. Is that something that you do apart from your parents?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, My father was the pilot in our household and got his license in the late 20s, early 30s. My mother was a white-knuckled passenger with him, and he would occasionally have her sign his logbook. Air travel was a little less reliable then, and I know even now at 87 years old, her very steady hand belies the fact that when she signed Sam's logbook, occasionally it looked like she held the pen with both hands. So I'm not sure that her flying time early on, she was never a pilot herself, but she has flown aerobatics with my sister, who's a member of the U.S. aerobatic team, and she's flown in helicopters with me when I had the privilege of serving on the United States helicopter team. So while not a pilot herself, she has flown with all of us in all kinds of weather and all kinds of places.
I just had to ask.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. With that, we're going to close the public hearing and the work session on SCR 6.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hartung.
I would move Senate concurrent resolution number 6 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Hartung has moved Senate concurrent resolution 6 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further comments? Without opposition, so ordered.
Do you want to have Senator Clarno carry it?
We'll let Senator Clarno carry the bill. And now we'll move on to the fourth item on our agenda. And do we have a sign up sheet?
Oh, we do, but
like Sam Johnson had a motorcycle.
No.
Use that kind of
hat. If I need him. Wow. I do. That's interesting.
I didn't know all about it. I didn't hear it. I just.
We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 596. And it seems like that the chair is the only one that's real interested in this bill.
Oh, count me in.
Oh, all right. No, I've had a number of people request, number of superintendents of schools request that we consider public charter school districts. And so I did introduce the bill. I have, and I hope members have gotten copies of emails from at least one of those superintendents. The idea expressed to me in personal meetings with superintendents was that if charter schools are good for opportunity in education, why not charter districts? And so what the bill attempts to do is to establish a new type of public school called a public charter school district.
I guess I haven't got a copy of
the
any letters.
I brought the concept, and our good drafter of education issues, Cindy Hunt, I think did a pretty thorough job of incorporating the concepts that I had brought forward. And personally, I had hoped that we would have testimony here today in support of this. The person who had indicated he'd be here, father is seriously ill and he was not able to be here. But I know that Mr. Green has worked extensively with Rob Kramer, and that Rob was the one who was going to come and testify in support of the bill. I know there's some issues and around the concept, and I would like to invite Mr. Green, if you would.
Mr. Chair, I apparently do not have a copy of the letter.
Thank you.
afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. Sorry I did not sign up on the bill. The reason was I was over picking up my daughter, and I'm the coach of her softball team, and we have practice tonight at 5 o'clock, and I didn't know when you were going to get to the bill. So there are a couple of issues that Senate Bill 596 does bring up, and I'm not saying they're not able to be fixed, but there are issues within the bill that I think are policy decisions that need to be thought about. First and foremost, if you remember back to last session when we passed Senate Bill 100 and House Bill 2550, the two companion bills that created charter schools, there's a provision in the law that says that no more than 20% of a school district student population may attend a charter school. That's not in the ORS's because that does sunset. And I'm not sure when legislative council, and I would assume it was Cindy Hunt that drafted this, took that into consideration. I'm not sure if the bill would violate that prohibition or if they've amended that out. I didn't see it anywhere in there because it's not a statutory site. It's actually a chapter law because it does sunset. That provision does sunset, I believe, January 1, 2003. The other questions that were brought to my attention with regard to the bill, I'm not quite sure how the funding provisions of the charter school law work with this, because this assumes that a school district board would approach the state board to seek charter school status, charter school district status. And in the charter school law for a K-8 program, we fund them minimally at 80% ADMW of the school district's ADMW. I think it's general purpose grant per ADMW. And for a 9 through 12, 95%. I wouldn't think that a school district would want to enter into an agreement with the state board where they would perhaps lose money in creating a charter school district. And I'm not saying it's not fixable in the law, but those are some issues that have also been brought up. The other one that I was visiting with Greg McMurdo about from the Department of Education deals with the governance structure of a charter school district. Currently, a school district has an elected school board. Matter of fact, today is election day for school boards in the state of Oregon. The governance structure in this bill would say that needs to be identified in a charter. That may violate other provisions of the ORS where you have an elected school board if, in fact, the charter school district board is not going to be the existing board of that school district. Our advice to school districts have been with regard to charter schools that you should take every application very seriously, that there are timelines in the law that are going to be phased out, and if you want to roll out more charter schools than what's allowable under the law, you can seek a waiver from the state board for that. Additionally, we have always said we should wait for those waivers or those timelines to go away, that 20% cap, and then see what school districts want to do, because we're in the first 18 months of charter schools now in the state, and we have 12 currently up and operating. We have about 10 to 12 applications pending before school districts right now of, I believe, at least the last time I checked, 9 are going to be approved right away. The other 3, there's some negotiation going on, and the ones that have been turned down have been 2. So I'm not quite sure that districts, there may be some superintendents interested in doing it. This bill does raise some issues and some questions that I think may be fixable in legislation, but it does raise some issues with regard to the cap that's currently there, a governance structure and potentially violating election law with regard to school boards. And I'm not quite sure how we address that, but I'm sure council can figure out some way to do that. I'd be happy to answer any questions with regard to our charter school law or what's gone on.
Senator Castillo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, as you've just talked to school districts in general, what's the overall reaction to this concept? Are people feeling this is something worth exploring? They're, you know, kind of wary of it, or are people just kind of wondering how it would all work? What's your feeling as you talk with districts around the state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Castillo, with regard to a whole district becoming a charter school district, there's been some interest. Some school districts would look at it. They would want to be the applicant, as we define them in law, and also the sponsor. They wouldn't want to seek a sponsorship from the state board, I don't think, because I laid out the funding scenario. Even though they could draft an agreement that says all the funding stays with the school district, there is some interest in it from some of the smaller school districts. I haven't heard of the larger to medium-sized school districts yet want to convert over to a charter school district. And I don't believe we currently have in the nation a charter school district. But there is some talk about it, at least from some of the superintendents across the state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Jim, what would be the big upside to...
The idea, Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckard, the idea behind the charter school law is to give some flexibility to schools. And you'll remember from last session, we created a list of statutes, minimally, that a charter school would have to comply with. And we call those the list of unwaivables. Even the state board can't waive those. Public meetings law, public records law, safety, health and safety of students, non-discrimination statutes, a whole list of things that we wanted to be in there to protect kids mostly. And the rest of all the statutes that cover schools, which is the entire, almost the entire volume 8 of the ORSs and the rules promulgated by the department, would not be applicable to charter schools. So it's some freedom from some of the regulations. Included in that list, though, are the academic content standards under Oregon's Educational Act for the 21st Century and the statewide assessment system.
Those are unwaivable.
Those are unwaivable. A charter school, whether it's a district proposed under this bill or whether it's an existing charter school, cannot get out from underneath those requirements right now. So, Senator, I guess to be blunt, it's to get freedom from some of the other statutes and regulations that they believe may be causing them some problems in providing educational services to boys and girls.
Mr. Chair, just along those lines, and feel free, I'm just trying to get a sense of what a district might be able to do under this that they couldn't do today. I mean, in Beaverton, we're doing some things I know of that alternative schools and now charter schools and others. Just trying to get a sense of what creative things or what regulations would hamper.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckard, there may be... with regard to, I know some ideas around collective bargaining, because remember, collective bargaining is optional to the applicant. Are they going to collectively bargain? And there is some belief in some school districts that sometimes their collective bargaining agreements get in the way of doing some things educationally for boys and girls. Now, I don't know if that's what the impetus is from some superintendents, whether it's to get out from underneath collective bargaining or whether it's to get away from some of the other mandates that have come down on them. I can't answer that, what their impetus may be. One impetus I know is in small school districts, if they're a single building school district, they run up against that cap, that 20% cap that I talked about earlier. No more than 20% of a school district's population can be in a charter school. Small school districts, and the charter school has to minimally have 25 active students. Small school districts may run up against those caps and not be able to create a charter school. So that may be one way to get around the 25 student cap and the 20% cap that I talked about earlier.
As a proponent of the charter school from the beginning, one of the aspects or the desires of me, myself personally, was that we would have the flexibility to develop enriched programs of learning, be able to think outside the box, and operate under a charter that was approved by people that were competent to look at the charter and understand if this, in fact, bore acceptability. And I think you mentioned smaller schools, and that's where really the requests have come from. And my sense is that many of these smaller districts are suffering declining enrollments, and they'd like the opportunity as provided in the bill to attract students from other surrounding districts. And so they would be looking to provide an educational opportunity that was somewhat changed from the regular public schools and be able to attract students with their ADMW to their district so that they might continue to provide a rich educational opportunity. And I think that has been the uppermost sentiment among the superintendents that have talked to me about it, that they would like the opportunity to advertise their excellence of education and promote their school and to attract some students. And And I quite agree with Mr. Green that we need to, make some modifications here, make it clearer. For instance, on the funding issue and the governance issue, and we can do that, I think, with the help of legislative counsel. And I'd like, as we consider what we may do with this bill, I would like some folks to get together and see if we can address those issues, bring this back for a further hearing, and dispose of it.
Senator Hardin, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for introducing this bill. I can remember the day last session when we passed Senate Bill 100 on the floor of the Senate, and at 1 o'clock while we came in here to an education meeting, and my adrenaline was still running pretty good, and the first person to testify on whatever bill it was at the time, I said, "What do you think about charter schools?" He said, "I wish my district could be a charter district." And that was the superintendent of Lake Oswego at the time. And so that set in my mind that we have to make it possible. We have to meet the objections that Jim mentions there. And I think more than any other reason, the reason that we need to make it possible for districts to become charter districts is the flexibility. Jim, I remember you gave me a list or told me there's about 343 different rules and regs that a charter district or a charter school would not have to meet. And so it was, you take that time and develop opportunities for learning for our children. It's just, and you know, we came awfully close to doing that with our alternative schools, I always felt, but the charter schools, and Alex Medler from the U.S. Department of Education, who met in this building a number of times with us, and incidentally he is from Eugene, Oregon, told me, he said, "Tom, you've got the very best charter school law for a public charter school law in the nation, but he says you're only halfway there." He said, "I can show you laws in Massachusetts and Colorado that are not as good as yours as far as, you know, pursuing the public part of it." He said, "But you've got to implement them, and that's where the hard work is." And that's where we are now, implementing them. I think we should have probably 22 charter schools, approximately, or 24 by this fall. And if I say what I said from day one, the only reason for doing this is to improve the quality of the education opportunities for our kids. And we would not have a charter school law if it wasn't for Representative Deckert and Representative Gordley. Their support gave it the bipartisan part of it. And I agree completely with what Ryan says about, in our Beaverton district, we are doing a lot of charter school-like things without having an official charter school, and that's just because you know, charter schools are performing the way we hope they would. It would provide an example of what you could do if you could have some flexibility. And the other reason this is very appropriate that we do this now, in the New York Times this morning, story of the Edison Project in San Francisco. They operating schools for profit, and they raised all the test scores as agreed, but the school board, I guess it was, you know, the school board for San Francisco, just generally the board members did not like for-profit operations like the Edison Project. And we had the Edison Project in the Beaverton District. In fact, the school board was going to sign a contract with them to operate Findlay School. Well, they didn't sign the contract. But Findlay School operates just like a Edison Project school in a lot of respects, and very well accepted. But, of course, it's absolutely and completely under the control of the locally elected school board, which is so important. But where we need to have something like this, the city of New York is considering taking their five poorest performing high schools and turning them over to the Edison Project to see if they can, you know, rather than shut the buildings down and close the school, see if they can't use these ideas of Edison and also, I say, in charter schools and see how that works. And the other thing, I'm adamantly opposed to vouchers until we have exhausted every possible remedy for improving public school education. And I think charter schools can do that. And if we allow charter schools to operate the way they can, when I say allow it, it takes the cooperation of school board members and the State Department of Education, and most importantly, the legislature, we don't need vouchers because they will serve that job of making sure all of our children have a chance to learn. So this is very timely, and I hope that you will get things corrected in this bill so that we can move it on, because the timing could not be better. I know in talking to Secretary of Education Roderick Forrest, he likes charter schools very much, and he's willing to, you know, forget the vouchers until we've proven to ourselves, well, if charter schools don't work, we can't make them work, then we'll talk about vouchers. But I say that charter schools can improve, and I'm a big supporter of public education the way we conduct it now, except we can do better, and I think charter schools gives us that opportunity. Charter districts also in the same category.
Thank you. I appreciate your work with Rob and assisting charters around the state. I know it's without your help, we wouldn't have the success we've reached today. And it's been, a real benefit. If you and Rob might get together, anybody else you want to involve?
Well, Mr. Chairman, a couple of comments I guess I'd like to say. With regard to small districts, I've worked with several of them on, you know, they want to try to attract students so because they're a declining enrollment school district. And the current charter school law allows them to do that. It takes a little bit more work, but the ones that have been willing to do it, one that I can think of right off the top of my head is the Warrenton-Hammond School District up near Astoria. They're trying to attract kids. They want to create a program to do that. We talk about, you know, what laws and what waivers are available. There are some folks that are probably in this room and throughout the building that would have some concerns about waiving entire lists of statutes for school districts, none the least of which may be collective bargaining, may be public contracting laws surrounding Davis-Bacon requirements, prevailing wage requirements, a whole litany of things that are there that cover school districts to get a group of folks around a table that may have all the issues would take a pretty large room, but we could sure take a crack at it.
Hi.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Castillo.
Well, I hope also what would be at the table is the issue of making sure that every teacher in these charter school districts would be certified and have the high quality. We keep talking about accountability and wanting teachers to meet the needs of every student in our district, and we want them to have more training and demanding a whole lot more of our teachers and wanting more accountability, which is fine. So I hope that then we follow that up by making sure that these charter school districts don't have people in there who are not licensed and do not meet a very high standard that we've established for teachers in our classrooms. I would be very concerned about that because, as you know, our current charter school law allows people to teach in those schools who do not have a teaching certificate, and I'm very concerned about that.
And, Mr. Chairman, Senator Castillo, the way this bill is currently written, it would track that same 50% FTE requirement that's currently in the charter school law. And what we found, though, with most of the charter schools that have come across the state, most of them, almost 98% that I remember looking last, of the teachers in the charter schools that have been established thus far have a valid TSPC license right now.
Exactly.
Which has been the trend nationally with charter schools. But there would be the potential, as you pointed out, for 50% of the FTE not to have a TSPC-issued license.
I appreciate very much your help, your insights, and I'm going to, unless there's further comment from the committee, I'm going to close the hearing, and we will try to put together some folks to explore the the variety of issues that need to be considered in doing this. And I certainly feel like that it's maybe just a beginning in discussion. In 93, I couldn't even get a discussion on charter schools. 95, we finally did. 97, we passed it in the Senate. Couldn't get a majority in the House because I was off family reunion.
That's right.
One vote. We lost it in the House.
Yeah, that's right.
I wasn't there. But I think that it's not too early to begin the discussion, at least, and we'll see if we can craft something that we can pass. If we can't, at least we've not, I don't believe we wasted our time. So with that, I thank the committee and those in attendance, and we're going to adjourn the